A few years ago, I was working on a case with the Boulder County Bomb Squad up in the small mountain town of Nederland, Colorado. Prior to this, I'd actually never been to Nederland, and so I didn't know much about the town. During the time on the case I worked up there, I was working with the locals, members of the bomb squad, along with the local firefighters and police officers. And during the time we spent together, they ended up telling me about a local case that started with a murder in the 1970s and ended with their involvement in 2016. After hearing everyone's personal accounts and retellings of the story, I couldn't help but think that it sounded a lot like the plot of an old movie, one where a lone town marshal is pitted against a young group of hippie outlaws, resulting in a murder that went unsolved for 26 years. And then to settle an old vendetta, an explosive plot for revenge is laid out. This is a case that has since turned into folklore for the small town. Originally, it was talked about in hushed whispers and wild rumors. And now, over 50 years later, after all of the events unfolded, this story has officially cemented itself into an overall wild history that makes up the town of Nederland, Colorado. I'm Em, a former special agent.
And I'm Katie Kaplan, an investigative journalist, and you're listening to Two Sleuths.
Warning. This podcast contains graphic content that may not be suitable for all listeners. All suspects or persons of interest discussed on this podcast are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Listener discretion advised.
Boulder, Colorado is a well-known city in the United States and perhaps instantly recognizable for followers of true crime as the site of the infamous and still unsolved murder of JonBenet Ramsey. But to Colorado locals, the town of Boulder has set itself apart from the rest of the state, and many refer to it as the Bubble, or the People's Republic of Boulder. And a lot of that has to do with the reputation the town gained back in the 1960s. According to the website aboutboulder.com, it became known as the hippie capital of the world, where an overflow of flower children collected. Many people who protested the war and promoted love and peace flocked to Boulder, where the creative and like-minded individuals gathered together, shared their philosophies, and celebrated the freedom they were seeking to live life on their own terms.
The 60s were a tumultuous time in the U.S., with political assassinations, the civil rights movement, and protests over the Vietnam War. And during this time, the hippie movement sprouted across the country. A counterculture with a foundation of peace, love, and anti-war as the pillars of its philosophy. The majority of people who were subscribed to this were nonviolent and didn't cause many problems. Some lived in groups or families. But as with most ideologies, there were some extremists, those who were less on the peace and love side and more on the anti-work, pro-drug aspects of the culture. And out of this dark and seedy subsect grew the STP family. Now, the group originated in New York City. But by the late 1960s, early 70s, there were members living near Boulder. Now, there's some debate over how this group actually got their name. One of the most common beliefs is that the group was heavily into drugs, and so they just named themselves after the street name of one of the most popular hallucinogenics at the time, STP, which stood for Serenity, Tranquility, and Peace.
But another theory is that the three founding members actually used their astrology signs for inspiration: Sagittarius, Taurus, and Pisces. In one article I read, the New York STP family was described as the junior league of the United Auto Workers Union. The UAW consisted of hardened blue-collar workers that pushed all manner of anarchy and had a reputation for being fearless when it came to the police. The junior leaguers, however, were known less for their violence and more for making and selling drugs. And police were aware of this too, apparently. So in 1967, after several drug raids, most of the family hopped on a bus headed to San Francisco to check out the vibrant scene in the city's Haight-Ashbury district, which was quickly becoming a base for hippie culture. During this transition, some of the STP family decided to venture out on their own, breaking off from the group to settle in Boulder.
According to one person who lived near Boulder at the time, it took one look at the STP family to know they were a bit different from the other hippies who had flocked to the city because of their ratted hair, body odor, and eccentric dress. I really liked this quote from an article in Vice called The Filthiest People Alive, where the writer, Steve, says, "Even in wide open Boulder, their appearance on the street was head-turning, like a hairy mountain theater troupe with a grimy, destitute sense of costuming," end quote. Steve and his friend Dana had become acquainted with the group by chance, running into them while they were ditching school in Denver to explore the LAC scene over in Boulder. Apparently, this group took the term dirty hippie to heart, claiming it as their own and living it to the fullest extreme.
In this article, Dana goes on to paint quite the picture, but to sum it up in a single word, the word that comes to mind is filthy, which is probably an understatement. The clothes they wore were dirty, tattered, full of holes, and almost disintegrating. And as they didn't bother spending money on underwear, anyone they walked past got more than an eyeful of genitalia. And the STP family were known to have their own unique brand of cologne, which was really just the overwhelming stench of urine. As no one in the group had any kind of work or gainful employment, they went about earning money from selling drugs or panhandling. And so they took to squatting in a section of abandoned houses that was set for demolition. And these houses were described as being full of human waste.
And as if that wasn't a big enough turnoff, listen to this. Members of the Boulder STP family would apparently sport some very unique headgear. They would wear animal skulls on top of their heads like a bonnet and bones around their neck. So quite the sight and smell, apparently. And none of them went by their real names. They all had nicknames, which lent to their style and lifestyle choices. Some of the ones we found in newspaper articles were Itchy Richie, Patty Rottencrotch, Toothless George, Rancid Ranny, and Poop. Yes, just poop.
And it was this subset of the STP family that today's case focuses on. While I was working between Boulder and Nederland on that case, the stories I heard from this group were from some old-timers I worked with, and they told me about the overall reputation that this group left behind. Beyond the stories I heard, I also cross-referenced what I could find between newspapers and online articles that have been written about this group. And then I came across this blog post written by somebody who actually had run-ins and experiences with the STP family, and he talked about how he always tried to avoid them. But what I think is kind of ironic about this blog post is that if you read in the comment section, several of the STP family members actually found the blog and used the comment section to connect with one another after decades. And in the comments, they shared stories about the good old days and update each other on what's been happening with the members they lost track of and those who have died. It all made for a pretty fascinating read and will be linked on our website.
The Boulder STP family also had several men who had returned from tours in Vietnam and had seen combat. And studies have shown that one in three men struggled with PTSD after Vietnam as they were working on reintegrating into a society where many people not only opposed their participation in the war, but actually view them as traitors instead of heroes. In fact, many Vietnam veterans returned to America and were spit on by protesters. So some of these men, and the family as a whole really, carried firearms and other weapons, which marks yet another difference between the STPers and the overall hippie generation. Now, as the daughter of a Vietnam combat veteran who suffers from PTSD, I just have to take a moment and say there were many Vietnam vets who came back from deployment, thousands with PTSD, who did not choose this life. The Boulder STP family had a reputation for aggression and violence. According to that article on Vice, some of the family liked to pass time by doing drugs, panhandling, or even terrorizing passerbys. The locals began trying to steer clear of the group, and reports show that members were arrested for shoplifting, vagrancy, armed robberies, public drug use, and various other crimes. One police officer even says that he arrested every member of the STP family at one point or another, and many of them he arrested several times. Aside from terrorizing the town, they were also adding to its degradation, selling really poor quality acid at a popular hangout spot for locals and college students called The Hill.
Several members of the STP family actually died of drug overdoses, and others in more infamous ways. A man named John Kirkland, who is actually considered to be one of the three founding members of the STP family and was therefore known as STP John, ended up settling with the group that ended up in Boulder. On the night of July 11, 1970, he and other members of the STP family were said to have crashed an apartment party in Boulder. As STP John pushed his way into the apartment, he was confronted by a man named Robert Coleman. The two started fighting, and Robert pulled a gun and shot STP John 4 to 5 times. In return, Coleman was stabbed several times. However, While John didn't survive, Coleman did.
While some of the SGP members lived in town, a large group lived in a rough makeshift camp in the woods outside the town of Nederland. It's located just a short distance up the mountain from Boulder. Today, there are about 1,500 residents, but back then, around 1970, there was a fraction of that, with only about 500 people. So it was a small and close-knit community, and crime rates were low. For that reason, when the STP invaded, so to speak, Nederland, the town took notice of an uptick in crimes, from property damage to confrontations with a group that were growing in violence.
The campsite the STP family claimed was made of crude teepees and lean-tos, using whatever tarps, rags, and even animal skins they could cobble together. When this group wasn't spending their time at camp, they ventured into the town and became well-known and feared by the locals. 19-year-old Guy Howard Goner was one of the more well-known members of the Nederland STP contingent, and he went by the street name of Deputy Dog, after the 1960s cartoon character. Now, we don't actually know if the name came first or if it was actually his penchant for carrying around a cap gun sewn into his vest that earned him the nickname, but he seemed fond of it. He went on to earn himself a reputation for tormenting the locals by pulling the cap gun out and shooting it off at locals and tourists in town, scaring them into thinking it was a real gun.
Deputy Dog was originally from Minnesota. According to various reports, he grew up in a lakefront home in an affluent neighborhood. There's not a whole lot published about his family life, but from what I gather, he had a couple of siblings and left home, hitchhiking to Boulder in an effort to dodge the draft. Deputy Dog had a reputation for being a nuisance. One story I read about him was how he went on stage at a live music venue after the band had stopped playing and then smashed one of their guitars out of nowhere. But despite his disagreeable demeanor, he is the victim in today's case whose life was stolen from him. He may have had a turbulent life, but as we'll find out, there are clearly people who cared for him and never forgot him.
Being the small mountain town it was, Nederland was left to be covered mostly by the Boulder County Sheriff's Office. However, there wasn't actually a sheriff's presence in town. After the STP family staked out their territory in Nederland and directly leading to that uptick in violence and crime rates, the Nederland City Council searched for a man they thought could handle the rough and rowdy newcomers. And in their search for such a man, they found Korean War veteran and Air Force fighter pilot Renner Leroy Forbes and swore him in as the town marshal. Soon after he pinned on the badge, he quickly earned himself a reputation as a no-nonsense lawman.
Several people in the town formed a rough opinion of Marshall Forbes, and in articles he was often referred to as a bulldog, and not in a good way. But the locals were hopeful he would use that kind of tenacity to help clean up the town. And no sooner than taking up his new position enforcing town laws did he come to realize that most of his time was spent keeping the STP family in line.
Calls came in constantly regarding disturbances being made at various businesses around town, most of which were being led by Deputy Dog and his crew. Within the first few months as marshal, records showed that he personally arrested Deputy Dog 12 times. On each occasion, the marshal had to take the 30-minute drive alone with Deputy Dog to the Boulder County Jail for booking. And yet, after every arrest, Deputy Dog was released and he made his way right back to Nederland. It was clear by that point that Deputy Dog was becoming quite a thorn in the marshal's side. It took less than a year for the new marshal to reach a boiling point, and the tensions between the town, Marshal Forbes, and the STP family were at an all-time high.
And that is when everything came to a head, on a July night in 1971 at the well-known and historic Pioneer Inn. Picture an old saloon-style bar where the town locals and hippies converged. The Pioneer Inn is actually still a pretty famous place in Colorado. That same year, in 1971, it had begun hosting live music, and it's located just down the road from the well-known Caribou Ranch recording studio. So by proximity, at times, people had the chance to see music legends like Robert Plant and Stevie Nicks perform when they would spontaneously drop by.
July 17th, 1971 was a hot summer night. Deputy Dog and the other STP family members were at the Pioneer Inn, drinking to excess and causing problems for the bar owner, Peter Lund. And so Peter called Marshal Forbes and asked for his assistance. The marshal arrived and pulled Deputy Dog out of the bar and threw him into the back of his patrol car and drove off. Members of the STP family watched the two drive off, just assuming their friend was heading to Boulder to be booked and thrown in jail. But that wasn't the case. Nobody ever saw Deputy Dog again.
Rumors flew as people speculated on what might have happened to Deputy Dog. Eventually, two different versions about what the marshal said happened came out. In one, he told people that he drove Deputy Dog back to the STP camp and then left him there. And in the other, the marshal said he drove Deputy Dog to the edge of town and told him if he ever returned that he'd kill him. Now, the second version likely fanned the flame of speculation that the marshal may have actually killed Deputy Dog that night.
Weeks went by, and the longer the STP family went without seeing or hearing from Deputy Dog, the more they became convinced that something bad had happened. Their suspicions were confirmed 5 weeks after he went missing. A body was found approximately 25 miles up into the mountain, off a dirt road, known by locals as Oh My God Road, aptly named as parts of it are narrow switchbacks that run alongside a sharp mountain drop-off. It was along this road that another more desolate one turned off, with a canyon lying below. It was here in this area where two hunters came across the human remains.
Even though it wasn't far from the town of Nederland, the body was found across county lines, placing the jurisdiction for the investigation in the hands of the neighboring Clear Creek County Sheriff's Office. Investigators examined the remains at the scene, then brought them back for an autopsy. However, the body was so badly decomposed that only a partial autopsy was able to be performed, and fingerprints couldn't be taken because of the state of the body tissue. So this made the body harder to identify. One of the better clues could be found hidden in the autopsy report, a small note that the victim was dressed in hippie-type clothing.
The cause of death was found to be a cerebral hemorrhage due to a .22 caliber gunshot wound to the right side of his head, which then determined the manner of death as homicide. Now, it's worth noting that many sources have said that Deputy Dog was found with two separate bullet wounds. However, when I came across the official affidavit, it only cites that during the autopsy, the victim was only shot once. But you'll see as we continue through this case, that number keeps coming back to two gunshot wounds.
Roughly a week after the body was found, Detective Sergeant Kirk Long in Boulder received a missing persons alert from the Minnetonka County Sheriff's Department in Minnesota. The report was for 19-year-old Guy Goner, as known as Deputy Dog. His parents believed he had been living in Boulder, but remember, this was back in the early 1970s, so communicating wasn't as quick and easy as it is today. His parents also said they had received information that led them to believe their son's disappearance was the result of foul play. After reviewing the report, a quick query of the local police database turned up Deputy Dog's multiple arrests in Nederland, which confirmed he had been in the area.
So Detective Long then requested Deputy Dog's old dental records from Minnesota. Within weeks, he had them in hand and then headed over to Clear Creek County, where he had heard that an unidentified male had recently been found murdered. After comparing Deputy Dog's dental records against the unknown victim, it was official. The murdered man was in fact Deputy Dog, and thus the investigation began. Sergeant Long spent time around Nederland, talking to locals and STP family members, all of whom had about the same story. The Deputy Dog was last seen being dragged out of the Pioneer Inn by Marshall Forbes on July 17th. Sergeant Long looked at the timeline, and he realized that the state of decomposition that Deputy Dog's remains were found in put the death date around the time he had last been seen while he was taken away from the marshal 5 weeks prior.
Obviously, investigating a fellow law enforcement officer is tricky, and I can imagine a sensitive thing too. So Sergeant Long was discreet in his investigation and didn't confront Marshal Forbes about it immediately. He began quietly asking around town and then caught wind of two conversations Marshal Forbes had with other Boulder County deputies. The first was about 9 days after Deputy Dog was last seen, and the marshal had said he had taken Deputy Dog to Clear Creek County and that it would take him a long time to find his way back.
The second was with a detective who had been lamenting to the marshal about the issues that they were having in Boulder with the hippies committing crimes in their area. Now, according to this detective, Marshal Forbes then said this: "You ought to shoot the bastards. There are plenty of places around these mountains. You could dump the bodies and no one would be the wiser." It would be about 3 weeks after this comment that Deputy Dog's remains would be found off that remote road.
By the end of September, Sergeant Long had enough probable cause to obtain a search warrant for the marshal's home, his office, his vehicle, and that of his wife. According to reports, when all of the law enforcement agencies showed up to actually serve those warrants, Marshall Forbes was visibly shaken, but he maintained he did not play a role in Deputy Dogg's murder. During the course of the searches, law enforcement seized a .22 caliber Mossberg rifle and Marshall Forbes' work log.
The same day, Marshall Forbes consented to a polygraph examination, but the results were inconclusive. However, it wasn't a complete waste of time, because during the interview, they learned that the marshal had also been in possession of a .22 caliber Ruger revolver, which had since been given to his brother-in-law. The Boulder County Sheriff's Office was able to track the gun down and sent it to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, or CBI for short, along with the Mossberg rifle, so they could both be tested. Now, investigators wanted to see if the ammunition fired from either gun would match to the bullet recovered from Deputy Dogg's skull.
Now, if you watch a lot of TV, you are probably familiar with how this works. Each gun leaves a unique marking on the spent bullet. Forensic analysts can inspect the unique pattern of lands and grooves and the direction and dimensions of the twist to try and match it with other bullets possibly fired from the same gun. However, in this case, they wouldn't get that far because those unique markings weren't visible on the slug removed from Deputy Dogg's body because it had been disfigured. With additional testing, the lab was able to determine that the Mossberg rifle was likely not the gun used in the killing, so they could rule it out. The Ruger pistol tested as a possibility, definitely not the proverbial smoking gun needed to file charges. Unfortunately, back in the 1970s, the case against the marshal was barely circumstantial and not enough to convince the district attorney to move forward with charges. Within a year of Deputy Dogg's murder, Sergeant Long was at a stalemate, and the case went cold. The last line in the case file read, quote, "The only other possibility in connecting Mr. Forbes to this crime is a confession," end quote.
Years passed and turned to decades. Life moved on. The STP family eventually left Nederland, dissolved and dispersed, moving to places like New Orleans, Berkeley, and parts of Texas. As for Marshall Forbes, not long after the investigation began, he was actually fired as town marshal after getting into a fight where he was then charged with assault. He actually ended up pleading guilty and then leaving town. He moved to Kansas to live and work on his mother's farm. And the truth about what happened that summer night in 1971 grew into a sort of urban legend told around town about a once corrupt marshal tied to an unsolved murder.
But that urban legend was still a very real experience for Deputy Dogg's friends and family. Even people who worked at the Boulder County Sheriff's Office couldn't forget the time when one of their own was suspected of murder. And that was especially true for a man named Bill McCaw, who 25 years after the infamous Deputy Dogg murder, had climbed his way to the rank of captain in the Boulder County Sheriff's Office. And by way of complete coincidence, or maybe it was fate, Captain McCaw would cross paths with former Marshal Renner Forbes.
It was 1996, and Captain McCaw was touring nursing homes for his mother in North Glen, a suburb north of Denver. As he strolled down the halls in one of the facilities, he looked at the names of residents posted outside their doors. And suddenly, there was one he recognized. Captain McCaw came to an abrupt halt as he read the name Renner Leroy Forbes, a name he couldn't forget. When he got back to his office, he pulled out the old case file on Deputy Dogg's murder. Realizing the potential opportunity that lay before him, he reopened the case.
The decades-old case file landed on the desk of Detective Stephen Amesworth, who started the painstaking process of reviewing every detail of the original report. He then reached out to the Clear Creek County Sheriff's Office to collaborate. Reinvigorated, the agencies compared their case files to another and learned that each one contained pertinent details the other didn't. For example, when they got to the crime scene photos, they noticed drag marks in the dirt leading to where Deputy Dogg's body was, which would indicate it had been dragged there while he was at least unconscious, if not dead, and that was something that hadn't been mentioned in at least one of the reports. Together, these deputies made a plan of attack for how to proceed with the case, and they connected with the original investigator, Sergeant Kirk Long.
Next, they went to the nursing home, unannounced, and spoke to the administrator to learn the details about former Marshal Forbes' physical and mental condition. They learned that his wife had passed away, his son had stopped visiting him, and the only person who actually came to see him on occasion was his daughter-in-law. As for his physical state, he had suffered a stroke, and he also had a degenerative neurological disorder, which impacted his movement and ability to balance, among other things, leaving him bound to a wheelchair. Aside from that, the administrator didn't believe that he had any cognitive impairments that would prohibit him from being questioned by law enforcement.
This was good news for when the time came to interview Forbes, but before they could do that, the detectives had to continue with their investigation, and they interviewed anyone and everyone that was still around and had been involved in that initial investigation. This included the owner of the Pioneer Inn from that time and a former member of the STP family. This new investigation had started in September of 1996. This new investigation had begun in September of 1996. Several weeks in early December, they were conducting one of the last interviews they needed before they'd be ready to make that surprise visit to interview former Marshall Forbes in the nursing home. However, I'm sure a lot of you remember what happened in Boulder in December of 1996. We had mentioned it earlier. Young beauty queen JonBenet Ramsey was found murdered in the basement of her home the day after Christmas. Her murder was an all-hands-on-deck situation, pulling resources from throughout the department, and thus Deputy Dogg's cold case was once again moved to the back burner.
8 months later, Boulder Detective Ainsworth learned that his counterpart at Clear Creek County had finally gone down to the retirement home to interview Marshall Forbes. The interview was recorded, and investigators confronted former Marshall Forbes with the most recent investigation into him. But Forbes denied any involvement with Deputy Dogg's murder. And so they turned off the tape recorder. It was only once the tape recorder was off that Forbes made the comment that everyone in the room already knew what really happened to Deputy Dogg. So the Clear Creek detective pulled out a photo of Deputy Dogg to show Forbes. He told him that it was time that his parents knew the truth. And so while the recorder was still off, Forbes started talking.
The former Marshall said that on that night in July of 1971, he received a call about a disturbance at the Pioneer Inn. He responded and found Deputy Dogg causing a ruckus and put him in the back of his patrol car without handcuffs. He said he then took Deputy Dogg back to his camp, but as he was opening the back door to let him out of the patrol car, Deputy Dogg grabbed his service pistol that was strapped underneath his arm. An altercation started as they both began to wrestle for the gun. Forbes said he was able to get the gun out of Deputy Dogg's hands, but as he did, he was knocked down to the ground, and that was when Deputy Dogg took off running. In response, former Marshal Forbes said he shot him twice in the back between his shoulder blades, but Deputy Dogg kept running and made it to the woods and down into a ditch where Forbes could no longer see him.
He continued his story by saying a woman holding a baby appeared, and she began yelling at Forbes to leave Deputy Dogg alone. But Forbes ignored her and yelled for Deputy Dogg to walk out with his hands up and that he would take him to get some help for his gunshot wound. So Deputy Dogg came out of the tree line, and Forbes said he walked over to where Deputy Dogg was standing so he could help carry him back to the car. He said as soon as he reached him, Deputy Dogg attacked him again, and this time he started choking Forbes. Before he passed out, Forbes said he shot Deputy Dogg in the head, and then he went to put Deputy Dogg's body in the car, but the woman stopped him and insisted that she would take care of the body and to just leave him there. And so Forbes said he left. He concluded by saying that he came back later, but Deputy Dogg's body was already gone, and he didn't know what had been done with it.
Investigators now had a confession, but Forbes had refused to allow them to record it, so they left the nursing home empty-handed. But this wouldn't be the only time Forbes would recount the events of that night, and it changed every single time. Eventually, the investigation was completely handed over to Detective Ainsworth, as it appeared the murder occurred in Boulder County. After the confession happened, Detective Ainsworth went back to the nursing home with a partner, and he asked Forbes if they could take him up to Nederland and have him show them around. Forbes agreed to this, and so they loaded him and his wheelchair into a specially equipped van.
Forbes directed them to the STP family's campsite. When they helped get Forbes out of the van, he brought them to where he said he dropped Deputy Dogg off that night. Once they got to the actual spot, Forbes stopped and threw up. After collecting himself, he started to retell the story about what happened that night. And when he got to the part about Deputy Dogg grabbing his gun from him, Forbes stopped talking and vomited again. After this, he didn't go back to talking about the events of the murder. Instead, he began chatting about things like a vigilante committee that was forming back then among the locals to handle the STP family on their own. He also talked about the woman and the baby who was there that night. He said he assumed that she was Deputy Dogg's girlfriend, but he never saw her again, and he never found out her name. According to Forbes, she was the only witness to the events that happened the night of Deputy Dogg's murder.
After Forbes was brought back to the nursing home, investigators returned several times to try and get him to confess on tape. Each time, Forbes changed some part of his story. In one version, the girl at the camp started attacking Forbes, and he accidentally shot Deputy Dog during the altercation. In another version, Forbes had walked Deputy Dog into his tent, and they started fighting in there, and Forbes shot him in the head. Then after shooting him in the head, Forbes said that he left the campsite, and he last saw Deputy Dog standing inside the tent, apparently alive and totally fine. He continued to tell investigators he had no idea how Deputy Dog ended up being found miles away in the canyon.
Now, the thing about these confessions is it looks like Forbes is obviously trying to minimize his involvement in Deputy Dog's murder. Now, he did admit to shooting Deputy Dog, but in most of the versions he told, he left Deputy Dog at the campsite while he was still alive. But they do go on to learn one new piece of information throughout all of these confessions. He told investigators that the murder weapon was actually a Ruger Bearcat, and he had it in his possession back when all of the search warrants were executed at his home and on his vehicles. He said it was under the front driver's seat of his wife's car, and the officers actually missed it when they executed their search warrant. Afterwards, he said he gave the gun to a friend, and police tried to track the gun down, but the friend that Forbes said he gave it to had traded it years prior and now had no memory of who had it.
Eventually, Forbes arrived at a final version of how the night unraveled, and this time he allowed investigators to record his confession. Forbes said that he didn't handcuff Deputy Dog when he put him in the back of the patrol car that night because he was being cooperative initially. But when they arrived at the camp, Deputy Dog lunged for and was able to take Forbes' gun out of his holster. Forbes says he actually had no trouble in getting the gun back from Deputy Dog because of how weak and drunk Deputy Dog was. Then Forbes claimed a woman jumped on his back, and it was only in the course of trying to get her off that the gun actually discharged and hit Deputy Dog, at which point Deputy Dog ran to the trees and down a ditch.
The whole series of confessions are about as clear as mud within the affidavit. So much changes, and most of the time, Forbes said he shot Deputy Dog twice. However, as I mentioned earlier, the affidavit that refers to the autopsy says they only found one gunshot wound. I think eventually, investigators gave up on getting the full truth from Forbes and decided to move forward with what he presented as the final version. Forbes admitted that once Deputy Dog was down the ditch, he told him to come out and he would take him to the hospital, but Deputy Dog said he was injured so badly that he couldn't get himself out of the ditch. And so Forbes backed his car up to the ditch, grabbed a rope, and tied one end to his bumper and the other around Deputy Dog's feet, and pulled him out with his car. He didn't exactly specify at this point, but it appeared that this was when Forbes realized that Deputy Dog had died. He said that the woman actually helped him load Deputy Dog's body into the trunk of his car. And that's when Forbes drove to Virginia Canyon and dumped Deputy Dog's body there.
Detective Amesworth presented the case to the DA. This time, they agreed to move forward with a second-degree murder charge. At the age of 69, the former marshal was brought into court where Deputy Dog's family and the DA had agreed on a plea agreement, which was offered to Forbes. A reduction of charges from second-degree murder to voluntary manslaughter in exchange for serving the rest of his life on probation. Deputy Dog's sister had spoken up prior to that sentencing and said that she would never forgive Forbes for taking her brother away from their family. Forbes didn't live much longer, as he died 2 years later at the age of 71.
While it might have taken 27 years, eventually Guy Gohner, aka Deputy Dog, and his family finally had the truth. And it would seem that that was the end of this tragic case and story. However, not everybody was satisfied with the outcome. Specifically, Deputy Dog's good friend and fellow STP family member, Midget Jesse. Now, that was his STP family street name, but his real name was actually David Ansbury. And the way he saw it, vengeance was still owed. Now, David had left Nederland with the others, and he had been living in San Rafael, California. But towards the end of 2016, he made his way back to Colorado to set his plan for revenge in motion. On October 11th, 2016, it was early in the morning when one of Nederland's five police officers was first to arrive at the police station to start his shift. Now, I've been to Nederland Station several times, and it's definitely an unusual setting. The station sits in a small two-story strip mall located in the tiny downtown area, And the strip mall itself is actually attached to one of the only grocery stores in town. So needless to say, it was pretty much one of the most populated public spots in all of Nederland.
As that officer headed into work, he noticed a duffel bag that had been left behind in a parking spot near the front of the police station entrance. The officer thought maybe it was just lost property, and so he picked it up and brought it inside with him. At one point, he opened it up, and inside he found a cell phone, light bulb, battery, and a jar of white powder all connected with wires. Even the untrained eye could determine they were looking at some kind of improvised explosive device. With no time to waste, the officer left the bag where it was and began evacuating the businesses and people in the nearby strip mall while the Boulder County Bomb Squad arrived.
Now, an IED can have several different triggers, and seeing the cell phone connected to a battery means that it's most likely going to be activated by the perpetrator calling the cell phone, therefore completing the circuit and detonating the explosive. So when the bomb squad showed up, they quickly put the cell phone into a Faraday bag. Now, these bags are used to block the signal of a cell phone, therefore removing the threat of the circuit being completed. Using a robot equipped with a laser, they were able to determine that the powder was in fact HMDT, or hexamethylene triperoxide diamine, a highly volatile explosive powder. The bomb squad rendered the device safe by placing sandbags around it and then firing a steel slug into the jar of powder, causing it to explode in a contained environment.
Luckily, no one was injured, and the federal investigation began with looking into the cell phone. And investigators learned that prior to the bomb squad rendering the device safe, several calls and two text messages were made to that phone in an attempt to detonate the device. Through search warrants, they were able to learn that the phone was a burner purchased from the nearby King Soopers grocery store only days beforehand. Investigators went to the store and were able to pull the security footage for the time the purchase was made, and they saw it was a man about 3 feet 6 inches tall with a long ponytail who was using crutches, and they watched as he paid cash for the phone. Obviously, the description of the man is fairly unique, so investigators relate it to the Nederland police chief, who just happened to recall seeing someone fitting that description when he was helping to evacuate a motel near the strip mall. When agents went to the motel, they were able to confirm that a man matching that description had rented a room there the night before the bomb was left. They pulled the records of his stay and learned his name was David Ansberry. They also interviewed a waitress who served David, and when she chatted with him about his visit from out of town, David told her he was there to, quote, take care of business.
After the strip mall and police department were safe to return, investigators noticed on the window of the laundromat, which was connected to the police station, there was an old STP sticker that hadn't been there the day before. Written on the sticker was RIP Deputy Dog 71771, murdered by town marshal. They officially had enough evidence against David to make the arrest, and now they had a motive. They moved quickly, but learned that he was already boarding a flight out of Denver headed to Baltimore. The flight had a layover in Chicago, and agents were waiting as he got off the plane and took him into custody in the airport. In his possession, they found two additional STP stickers that matched the one left on the laundromat window. They also found a diary with an entry that said, Pioneer Inn, life goes on. No one remembers what happened in 71. Poor deputy. Revenge is called for. David was federally charged with 18 United States Code Section 844, which means maliciously attempting to damage or destroy, by means of an explosive, any property used in interstate commerce.
After the initial charge, he was indicted by a grand jury on a second charge, which was one count of attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction against a person or property in the United States. David pleaded guilty to this charge, and the initial one was dropped. When sentencing came, the court applied several enhancements, specifically a terrorism enhancement, because David's offense was proven to be in retaliation against government conduct. This brought his sentence up to 27 years in federal prison.
On appeal, David fought the terrorism enhancement, and he argued that it was not applicable because he didn't intend to retaliate against the police, but instead was only trying to remind the public about his friend's murder. And the appellate court ruled that David should be resentenced, sending the case back down to the lower courts for determination. In 2020, the new sentence was issued, and it had been dropped from 27 years to just 5, at which point 68-year-old David was released with time served. And that really is the end of the story.
In the end, Guy, Deputy Dog Goner's killer, was caught, But after so many years passing, while the former marshal was able to live out his life after stealing one away from a 19-year-old kid, many wonder, is it really justice? Deputy Dog didn't deserve to die.
But he deserves to be remembered. That does it for today's episode. You can head over to our social media accounts linked below and see pictures for today's case. And if you're listening and haven't left a review for us in your podcast player, doing so now would mean the world to us. We'll see you back here next week. And until then, stay vigilant.
And stay curious, fellow sleuths.